The first lecture was 18th century modes of production, the second property and stratification, and this third lecture is the 20th century and its exchange. The propensity, the inclination of human beings to exchange is thought by most economists to be absolutely basic to our human nature. I did quote, but we'll quote again, the founder of modern economics, Adam Smith, who says, the beginning of the Wealth of Nations, a certain propensity in human nature, a propensity to truck, barter and exchange one thing for another, is common to all men and is to be found in no other race of animals. Well, we now know that I think some animals do exchange things, but and they're exchanging things all the time of a symbolic and other kind, but it is a very strong feature of ourselves, watching children grow up very, very early on, before they can speak. They give things to their parents give things to them. It's how we are as human beings. It's based on a double desire, as Adam Smith pointed out in his Moral Economy. One is the desire to compete, outdo, something to do with games and competition, to make marginal advantages, which we all love doing, and children love doing as much as anyone else, and all societies have this feature. And the other is the desire to be loved, as Adam Smith says, to get approbation, to get the esteem of other people, and that's why I bother about my lectures. I want you to actually enjoy them and appreciate them. I can't just come and give terrible lectures, although there's nothing directly in it for me except your approbation, really. So economics is about, modern economics is about exchange. The famous definition of economics by Robbins is, economics is the study of the allocation of scarce resources between alternative ends. But it's more complicated than that, and I want to go through now the different kinds of development of exchange systems that have been unravelled by anthropologists and others, and start with reciprocity and gift. The essence of 90% of human societies is that they are gift societies as opposed to commodity societies. In a gift society, you have multiplex relations. With you, I only have a single-stranded relation unless one of you comes up afterwards and we start talking or I teach you or something. You just have this single-stranded relationship of lecturer to lecturer. But in the majority of human societies, nearly all of them, you have multi-level relationships. So in such societies, when you any action you do, any word you say, and anything you give someone isn't just an object. It carries all sorts of symbolic and other weightings. Whether you give it, whether you don't give it, makes a huge difference to people. So you don't have single-level functional exchanges between people. You have total. What Maus, who is the great expert, some of you may have read parts of The Gift or heard about it, Maus calls the total prestation. Prestation is another word for gift. And it's total in that it involves your whole personality. It ties up with Marx, Karl Marx, of course, because in his image of simpler societies, when you make something, when you do something in the world, you put some of your own personality and your spirit into that. When you make a pot, it isn't just a pot. It is part of you. Now, that is still the case with potting, because Lily's my granddaughter's father, my son-in-law, is a potter, and he puts some of his spirit, as he says, and bad pots he has to break. He won't let me take them away because they're bad representations of himself. So people in arts and crafts still do this, but much of what we do is exchanging neutral objects, but in many societies you are involved in total exchanges. Now, there are different kinds of exchanges, of course, and this was famously the most interesting, I think, summary, if you want to read it, of types of exchanges in Marshall Salins' book, Stone Age Economics. There's one essay there on developing Maus's theories on gifts, and he splits exchanges and gifts into three main kinds. One is negative reciprocity. Negative reciprocity is, I won't be talking about, it basically means going up and hitting someone, or war. You give a gift to someone, but it's a negative gift, and it harms them. The other two main forms are balanced reciprocity. which is what our major form in a capitalist society is, where you use money to make exchanges very, very neutral. None of your, very little of your personality is involved, and there are almost immediately there's a return straight away. You give something, you give a shopkeeper some money, and then they give you the goods, and that's it. There's nothing more to it than that. A pure form of direct and balanced exchange. I give you £5 and you give me some apples or whatever. But the relationship is balanced, immediate, and soon ended. This kind of relationship is not appropriate at all in multi-stranded societies where people know each other and are going to go on in the social relationship. And you can see this, you know this, because you make a big distinction between the groups where you can do balanced direct exchange and groups where you can't. For instance, if my wife cooks me a nice meal, as she often does, of course, or even if I cook her a nice meal, which I occasionally do, if I pulled out my credit card and said how much, she might be a little hurt, and I might be a little hurt in reverse. The same with sex and everything else in our lives. In the family, you don't pay directly. If a friend comes round and mows the lawn for you, or if my next door neighbour comes round and sorts out my broadband connections, as he often does, I might in a few weeks give him a bottle of wine. But I wouldn't immediately pull out the chequebook and pay him, unless he spent an awful lot of time. So most of our life is deciding whether we're in a complex relationship where we give a gift and then return it later. In the famous biblical metaphor, we cast our bread upon the waters. I give you the gift of this lecture. One day one of you will become Prime Minister or head of Sony International or something and remember me then. I don't expect payment for this particular lecture. So you have that other kind of gift, which is called generalized exchange, or delayed reciprocity. This is generalized because it's, I may give you something, you may give someone else something, someone else may give someone else something, and then it comes back to me. It can go on a long cycle, as in the cooler, which I'll talk about later. A to B to C to D, and then back again. It's not direct, and it's not immediate. And there is no direct equivalence. You don't give me the exact amount back again. Now, there are two things about the Mauss's idea of the gift, which I think I've always found. I think Mauss's book is one of the greatest works of anthropology, because it really illuminates not just anthropology, but our whole lives. And one of the things he discovered was that gifts, things you give to people, not only have a physical body, the animal, plant, or whatever that you give to someone, but also an inner essence or spirit. This is concealed in capitalist societies, though it is also the case here, but when you look at Melanesia, as he did, and he looked at, the Polynesian concept of the hau, which is spelled there, H-A-U, this is the spirit of the gift. So a gift has two levels. It is an object. Does anyone know what this is, by any chance? Any guesses? Salt, did someone say? No, I'm deaf as well as everything else, so you have to shout. No guesses? One or two of you are from that part of the world, I would have thought. They use it as currency, yes. Okay.
It's a coconut, isn't it? Some form of, not coconut, but like some sort of nut.
No, it's tea. It's a block of tea, which is the main currency over Tibet and Mongolia until recently. But it also represents a lot of work. I went to a factory in Western China where they make these blocks of tea, and it's a lot of work making these. So something of a person goes into this. So in the Maussian gift, when you give someone a block of tea like this, within a context of a multi-stranded society, there is the physical block of tea, and there is this invisible spirit of the gift which is inside it. And it's a spirit both because it is conceived to be alive, but above all because something of the maker and their personality is within it. Chris Han, whose book I've recommended to you, describes the situation as thus. Mas argued, following, so he thought, the local model, that to give something was to give a part of oneself. The spirit of the gift was a link between the object given and the donor, which ensured that the object would eventually be returned. When you give a bit of your spirit away, it will come back to you. Mas emphasized the sense of obligation involved in all gift transactions. There was an obligation to give, but there was an obligation to receive and to repay. And from these various obligations, a kind of social order emerged. Now, this problem I ought to explain, and the problem of 20th century anthropology, is what holds together these kinds of simple societies which don't have a state, they don't have an economy, they don't have a legal system, they don't have an instituted religion. What is keeping people from falling apart? What is the cement that glues people together in the majority of human societies? And what he discovered is that it's this obligation to give and the obligation to repay. This is a total prestation. It's not a voluntary matter. You don't think to yourself, oh, well, today I'll give someone something. It's part of the total system, and there is a great compulsion both to give and to receive. Now, this idea has, to a certain extent, but not entirely, disappeared from our society. But you can see it in another aspect, both of the majority of human societies and our own, and that is in religion. Religion is all about gift-giving. I don't know whether it's occurred to you, but sacrifice, the idea of sacrifice, is largely about gift exchanges with the spirits, with the gods. Between the human and the spiritual world, you have these people or things or whatever they are up in another realm, and you need to try and encourage them to be nice to you. So you give them gifts. And I remember that my slight shock when I went to the Himalayas, where I did my field work over the years in the Himalayan village, because I went to my first animal sacrifice. They killed a cockerel in a little shrine, and then because someone had been ill or they thought they were bewitched or something, and I saw them pouring the blood on the altar stone, and then they took the cockerel off. I'd expect them to leave the cockerel there, but they took it off and they all ate it. I said, well, you know, the gods don't seem to be getting much out of this. You're eating the cockerel. Surely if it's a sacrifice, you should leave it for them. They said, oh, no, no, they're not interested in the physical sacrifice of the cockerel. They're interested in the spirit of the cockerel, the pla, as it's called, P-L-A-H, which is represented by a bit of the blood that symbolically expresses. We give them the spirit of the cockerel, and then they heal us and help our crops and so on and so on. So nearly all sacrifice, the whole of Christianity is based on the sacrificial idea of the sacrifice of the lamb to God, who to begin with was a real lamb, and then in the Old Testament, and then later became Jesus, who was our sacrifice back again. Strange sort of device. God gives us the object and then we give it back to him by killing him. But anyway, that sacrificial feature is central to nearly all religions. In Puritanism and Protestantism, it gets internalized. So all you don't sacrifice things, you sacrifice your own will and personality and soul and devotion to God. But there's still a sacrifice involved. Now, that's one feature of gift-giving. Another is that you can use gifts to fight wars with. There's a famous, well-known book on Melanesia called Fighting with Food by Michael Young, who worked on the trograms. But the most famous case of fighting with things is the potlatch. Some of you may have heard of this. I should have put this name up. The Kwakiutl, that's a K-W-A-K-I-U-T-L, of the Northwest Coast American Indians. Famously, before it was suppressed as wasteful and then has been revived somewhat, they famously, periodically, someone would challenge another person to a potlatch. When they had accumulated, these were the kind of hunter-gatherers I mentioned who accumulated large quantities of valuable things, oil from the salmon, woven rugs, wood carvings and other things. When they got enough of these, and they had a rival who also had a lot of them, they would say, I challenge you. I'm not sure whether the person in the back is trying to, attracting my attention, just trying to keep awake. They would light a fire, bring all their oil and rugs and other things to the side of the fire, and then the first one would throw on 2 gallons of fish oil or whatever it was. The other guy had to put on 2.5 gallons. You were now shamed by the exchange. You'd now have to throw on a couple of nice rugs. They'd throw on 3 nice rugs. And so it went on until the guy who had the most won, and the other person was put down. It's a form of conspicuous destruction of exchange to assert status. We do it all the time. You know, I don't know about you, and I'm not sure about me, but it is reputed that if someone buys a nice car and you have enough money, you try and buy a slightly nicer car, so that the car in your drive is slightly better than their car, and so on. Whether that's the case, the more extreme and obvious analogy is with the arms race. You have conspicuous destruction of much of the world's wealth. Most of the world's wealth now goes into making weapons, which very soon become redundant. But shame and put down your opponents. Mad, mutually assured destruction is based on conspicuous destruction and competitiveness in an arms race. Another element of the gift is that it's a way of storage of valuable things. In most human societies, you don't have any risk-free or any ways of storing what you make in the world. You don't have building societies, obviously. There's no Hong Kong and Shanghai bank available. So how are you going to save things for a rainy day when you're old or when you're sick or in the future when you need accumulated wealth for a wedding or some other occasion? What do you do? What you do is you give wealth away. You give as much away as possible. You force people to accept it. The classic example I'll show in one of the video classes is Onca's big mocha of New Guinea Highlanders, which I mentioned. And there you periodically kill pigs, have a great feast, give people things. That creates a debt because there's a spirit of the gift, and they have to, when you need it, when you want to call it in, they have to come back and give you a little bit more. I've seen this in Himalayan weddings. You have a wedding, you give a great amount of food and drink and things to people, but then people have to come along and give you large sums of money. Which, because when you went to their weddings, you gave them sums of money. So it's a time, an occasion to suddenly gather together large sums of money. So, as the Bible says, lay not up for yourselves treasures upon earth where moth and rust doth corrupt, but lay yourselves up treasures in heaven. Well, in most of these societies, you lay up some treasures in heaven through sacrifice, but you also lay up treasures through other people. Invest in other people is the best saving. And this, of course, is the quintessence of family life, even in your and my society in the West. I don't know whether how much you've thought about it, but the relationship between you and your parents is a complicated gift kind of relationship. Parents give love, shelter, food, clothing, and so on to their children over their first 20 or 25 years in the hope, maybe, that they will get something back. But whereas in most societies you would automatically get it back, the children would automatically look after you in old age and sickness and so on and so on, and you don't even think about it as a gift because you co-own all the property. In our society, it's always been the case that, when I say ours, I mean Western European, American, that kind of place, it's always been the case that there is a basic contract. If the parents are nice to you, be nice back to them. If they're not, you have no obligation. This is a very strange concept. In the majority of societies, it's immaterial. As long as they're your parents, they're your parents. But this is put most famously by John Locke, the philosopher. He says, "The honour due from a child places in the parents a perpetual right to respect, reverence, support, and his and compliance too, more or less, i.e. proportionately, as the father's fair cost and kindness in his education has been more or less." If they haven't been nice to you and they haven't bothered about you, then you have no obligation. This, of course, is the basis for his contractual theory of political power as well, because if the king isn't nice to his people, you have no obligation to the king. You get another king. It's a revolutionary contractual doctrine. But of course it seldom works. Very often what you have is a situation where parents are quite nice to their children, and then the children find it very difficult. They have their own lives, their own marriages, their own children. So we tend to have much more of a downward flowing situation where you're nice to your children, look after them, support them and so on. They then pay taxes, this is generalized exchange, they then pay taxes through their lives, which then go into the security and health system, which supports you. I'm in this situation now that I have children and now grandchildren, and I've given a lot to any surpluses I have, or most of them I give away to my children because I don't really want the stuff, and it's very nice they take it, but it's on the absolute understanding that they have no real obligation. If they feel later on I or my wife need help, it's up to them. We can't force, there's no pressure or force one can put. And the great literary example of all this, of course, is King Lear. How many of you know the story of King Lear? Well, basically King Lear abdicated his throne, this is Shakespeare's play, and when he abdicated his throne, he asked his three mortals if they loved him, and the first two, Goneril and Regan, said yes, of course they loved him. The third, Cordelia, said, I can't, don't force me, don't, you know. She did love him, but she wasn't going to be forced to say she loved him. So he went and stayed with the first two, who didn't really love him, and threw him out. And he was left with Cordelia, and gradually at the end he sort of realised that she really loved him, even though she couldn't be forced to say it. And so this is a wonderful treatment of the relations between parents and children in the English context. I now want to move on to barter and markets, because we're now moving into peasant societies, or just beginning to. At the beginning you have what is barter. Barter is basically, I give you this and you give me that, we exchange something. Now, barter isn't a gift because to take the extreme example, a hunter-gatherer society which has got lots of honey, say in the Nilgiri Hills in southern India, will go. They don't like the people who are in the villages and so on, but they will come to the edge of the forest, leave a pot of honey. They will only do it once, but they'll leave a pot of honey there. If the villagers come along with, say, a bit of woven cloth and leave it in exchange for the honey, then they'll do it again. And that is barter. It doesn't need any personal involvement, it doesn't carry any spirit of a gift. But soon it develops these things. You start with one pot of honey, but very soon you find there are lots of pots of honey and all sorts of other things being left around. And then people meet and they hang around, and you begin to get what are called peripheral markets. They often occur in another setting around a religious festival. People are meeting for to worship a god or something, and they bring along a few objects with them. You find this in South America and in Mexico and many parts of the world, and I've seen it in the Himalayas. It's on the edge of normal life. Most of your life is catered for by producing something which you then consume or gifting among yourselves in your village. But the edge of it, it develops these peripheral markets, which are very important. They're not basic things, but in the South American and other instances, you go there and then you buy or exchange things like baskets, pots, maybe salt, maybe long-distance trade items. And many market systems grew up like this, at places where people would meet for other reasons, are to universities, Cambridge, bridge over the Cam, and Oxford, the ford over the river, which has never existed as far as I know, the Ox, were places where people would come and meet. People have heard of the Ox, but it used to be called something else when I was a Charwell or something. And people would stop there, and then they would, a little market would grow up, and towns would become markets, as Cambridge has done. What you tend to get in these marketing systems are levels of markets. There was a very famous article by a man called Skinner, who wrote about Chinese markets, and what he found was that there was a deep pattern in Chinese markets, where you'd have a big city, like Shanghai or something, round it would be big middle-sized towns, which had middle-sized markets dealing with certain things. Each of these would have little, very small markets supplying them. Each would have different functions and different roles. So you had, if you can imagine a model, a central place, and then spikes off it with middle-sized markets and then tiny markets. The middle one would be there all the time, or the big one would be there all the time. The middle one might be a weekly market, and these other ones might be monthly or whatever, and they deal with higher level goods and so on. We don't really have that sort of thing, though it's very interesting what's happening to marketing in this country. The nearest I can think of as these kinds of lower level markets are car boot sales. How many of you have been to car boot sales? Quite a lot. Okay, well, you know more about it than I do then. I drive past them. I always feel as an anthropologist I should be going in there and analysing them. This is my fantasy about them, which is that people, it's really, I ought to go because I've got an awful lot of junk that I ought to get rid of, as my wife is always telling me, old computers and photographic equipment and so on. So I should go along with my car, open up the boot and deal with peripheral things. They're not, I imagine, you may be able to correct me, I imagine you don't take a huge load of Sainsbury's shopping and put it in your car boot, and food and very good clothes you just bought and so on. They are for the peripheral but useful sort of goods. So you have a garage full of this stuff, you take it to a car boot sale, you make a little bit of profit, you exchange, you meet your friends, and then you come back with a car loan laden with about the same amount of rubbish as you took. But you may have made a small profit. That's my fantasy of how it works. So our desire to barter and truck and exchange is fulfilled, maybe make a little profit, and also a hobby and an interesting sort of thing to do. It's like swapping at school, just like one did at school. Accumulate too many marbles or whatever, and exchange them for conkers or something else. But then you begin to get something bigger, which are fairs. And fairs are a really interesting phenomenon. They're the main exchange forum in peasant societies until very recently. What a fair is a place which, for say, a month or two, everyone comes and exchanges things. And Cambridge is a very good place to talk about fairs, because the biggest fair in the whole of Europe took place in Cambridge, on the edges of Cambridge, between its great heyday was about 1700. It's described by Daniel Defoe in his Tour of England, about 10 pages on it if you're interested in that. And you can see the traces of it. It's Stourbridge Fair, Stourbridge. You can, if you go out on the New Market Road and look at the names of the streets on your left-hand side and the pub signs, you can see the remains of that great fair. You'll see Cheddar Lane, which is where they sell the cheeses. You'll see Garlic Row, where they used to sell the garlic. You'll see the signs of, you'll see the Three Wrestlers Club, which is where they used to have the wrestling. They used to bring goods from all over Europe, from Scandinavia, from the Mediterranean, from north of Scotland, from the south, bring them there once a year for about a month and exchange them in a great fair. It had its own judicial system, its own laws, and it had a special hospital, which you can again see if you just as you go over the railway line. On the left-hand side, you'll see a medieval building, which is the plague chapel of Stourbridge Fair, where people who were ill were taken. And it was vast. It was a wheel around which many goods all over England and Europe were exchanged, and there were also these great fairs in Germany and France and Italy. They were killed, of course, by the railways, because these were water-based fairs, and by shops. People now wanted to be able to go every day and buy things, and better transport and shops killed these fairs. Although, in a sort of irony, they've sort of come back in a way, because the shops now have been killed by the supermarkets. And the supermarkets are perpetual fairs. They are places where goods come from all over the world, and you can't exchange things in the same way, obviously, but they have a life to them, which is much bigger than just a shop. You can go around them. There are plans. I've always imagined that one day we will live in these things. And there are plans now to put hospitals into them, which I imagine would have happened a long time ago. You'll be able to be born in one of these. Sainsbury's will have its own hospital where you'll be born, and you can wander around consuming, and then you'll die there, and you'll have your legal system. So you never have to go outside the consumer palace that has been built. So I now want to turn to the last 3 or 4 minutes on market economies. The essence of a market economy is that you have balanced exchange. Market here doesn't mean a physical place, it means a mentality, a way of looking at things, of thinking of things as objects which you exchange rather than things with any personality in them. And the great change, of course, is summarized by Marx as between what he calls CMC, commodities, which you produce, you then get some money for them, and then you buy some more commodities, which is a peasant way of looking at things, and our way of looking at things, which is I'm paid money as a salary, I then buy some commodities, and then I earn some more money. So CMC to MCN. In many societies, markets grew up because they were neutral zones. In most of life, in an embedded society, you can't really afford to get fair prices for things. If the priest or the ruler or whatever asks you for something, you have to give it to them for free. I remember a story of one of my aged aunts who was once visited by Queen Mary or one of the royal family. And as she was leaving, she said, "Oh, that's a lovely teapot you gave me a cup of tea from." That was the end of that teapot. Obviously, if the Queen expresses an interest in the teapot, you have to give it to them for free. You're under great constraint. But markets provide a neutral zone, and this is why they're often very important in peasant societies. If you're selling something in a market, it's an arena of market mentality, and if your local mafia boss or anyone else comes along, you can say, "Well, of course I would normally let you have this for free, but I'm afraid this is the rules of the market. I have to charge you the market price for this." So here, a market is an insulated area. And for a long time, it was very difficult to create these insulated areas. The ghetto, which is an Italian word meaning foundry or place where they make weapons, the first ghetto in Venice was set up because the Jewish people in Venice were able to deal rationally and without favour in market, with market principles. That was why they were so valuable. Their religion allowed them to trade and exchange without getting embedded and to lend money, usury. So you've got the development of this money economy on the fringes of embedded economies. So you've now got an exchange or a movement from a situation where you don't have any market values to peripheral markets, bounded markets, and then to a world like one we live in, which appears to be a total market. And yet, in fact, much of our life is actually outside the market. There are many things we can't buy and sell. I can't sell bits of King's College lawn to you, I'm afraid, or bits of the chapel, although I'm a hundredth part owner of it in the sense of being one of the 100 fellows or so. So, and I can't, love you can't buy, according to the Beatles, etc., etc. There are many things you can't buy and sell, even in the market economy. So there are always different levels within systems, and this is the last point I want to make. You find this even in very simple societies. The famous account of market of exchanges in Malinowski's Argonauts, the Western Pacific, and he describes three kinds of exchange. There's gimwali, that's G-I-M-W-A-L-I, that's haggling, roughly similar to market principles, and there's a lot of haggling of that kind. There's urigubu, U-R-I-G-U-B-U, which is a seasonal gift-giving of yams by a man to his sister's husband. So it's a sort of embedded exchanges, and they reinforce ties. And then there is the famous kula ring, K-U-L-A ring, in which two kinds of goods are exchanged with each other. There are shell necklaces called sulava. Which are exchanged in a clockwise direction, and armbands, known as mwali, which circulate in a counterclockwise situation. It's a ritualized exchange, and the main theory to explain this is that it, through these ritualized and apparently non-profitable long exchanges that occurred between islands, it allowed these other kinds of exchange also to occur. The danger, of course, is war between islands. And if you're exchanging something ritually, your mind is on that and you think less about your differences, and then it allows other kinds of exchanges within it. So, to end, we all live in a mixed market economy. We have the fantasy that we are highly monetized and we live outside the market, but in our family and with our friends and in many relations, including mine to you, it's not quite as simple as that. Thank you very much.